Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. So it's Friday and time for our week in review. We're going to start with immigration, which has been a developing story on several fronts all week, pretty much, including today. First, we have the news of the day, which is the fallout over President Trump's apparent remarks about a potential deal on DACA, or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. This deal reportedly was part of a larger spending bill, which has to be approved by next Friday to avoid a government shutdown. But the whole deal is now in limbo and mired in controversy. Yesterday, in a White House meeting, just a recap here, with a bipartisan group of lawmakers about the deal, President Trump is said to have used vulgar language to refer to certain countries. Today, the president is denying that he used that language, but Democrats are striking back, including Massachusetts Congressman Joe Kennedy.
This is outrageous on so many different levels. It's immoral. It's not who we are as a country. I think when we look back at some of our proudest moments as a nation, they are the ones where we aspire to live up to the words that are inscribed at the base of the Statue of Liberty.
And earlier this week, the White House rescinded TPS, or Temporary Protected Status, to Salvadorans. That affects some 6,000 people living here in Massachusetts. Here's Irma Flores, a Salvadoran TPS recipient living in Haverhill.
We have been contributing to the United States. We pay taxes. And this is it's just crazy because I don't think people will leave. And that is an issue for this country as well.
So we're going to ask our weekend review panel right now, is there any common ground on immigration reform? How is Massachusetts affected in all of this? And where might we go from here? Joining us in the studio, Joe Battenfeld, Boston Herald political reporter and columnist, and he's host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you very much, Deb.
Also with us, Michael Curry, former president of the Boston branch of the NAACP and member of the National NAACP Board of Directors. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too. So we're going to have to start with the president's comments and all of this controversy today. And I do want to warn our listeners that we will be playing a bit of tape that describes the president's comments, and that tape does contain some vulgar language. So here's a tape. Illinois Senator Dick Durbin said that he was at yesterday's White House meeting, and this is what Durbin told reporters that the president said.
And then he went on when we started to describe the immigration from Africa that was being protected in this bipartisan measure. That's when he used these vile and vulgar comments, calling the nations they come from shitholes. The exact word used by the president, not just once, but repeatedly.
We should say that the president did tweet today saying, quote, "The language used by me at the DACA meeting was tough, but this was not the language used. What was really tough was the outlandish proposal made. It was a big setback for DACA." So that's just today. Michael Curry, I'm wondering your reaction to all of this.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a reaction I think generally we have across the country that we're deeply disturbed by this president's comments. And folks, you know, often have used the term of unhinged when they talk about this president. Mm. I think there's another layer of it for those of us who are conscious of and concerned about racial issues in this country and are vocal on it, which is he tapped into something he's always tapped into when he was a real estate mogul and when he was a candidate. And now that he's president, he taps into the worst of America and the characterization of Africa and Haiti. And the appeal of having people come from predominantly white countries or countries that would the immigrants would be predominantly white speaks volumes about what we have leading the nation right now. And I think deeply disturbing and not American. And if you are a supporter who voted for him, I'd hope you're rethinking your vote.
There are some who say that the president's remarks were not racist. On NPR this morning, there was a lawmaker defending the president's remarks, saying it was merely a bad choice of words to describe the lawlessness in some of the countries where people have fled to come to the United States.
Someone said to me many years ago, and I've heard this from others, which is someone tells you who they are, believe them. This is not new for him. He either unconsciously shows his racism or he blatantly does it to play to his base. Either way, deeply concerning, and it is racist. And I think most people, if they're honest with themselves, not the spinners that he has on his team who spin this stuff, and they know they're spinning it, they know that this was a racist comment and that he plays on that.
Joe?
I do not believe Donald Trump's denial. I do. It sounds exactly like something Donald Trump would say. But I do think that among his base of support, most of his supporters probably have no problem with him saying this at all. They probably feel the same way. Many people feel the same way. And I do think, though, the bigger question is, how is this going to affect the overall immigration debate? Because there were signs that there could have been a compromise.
Right.
And now the question is this going to blow up any chances for a compromise? Because some senators had indicated that they made a deal before this in the meeting that they had. And then all the oxygen got sucked out by discussion of this word. So, and Trump is now kind of doubling down on that, saying, no, he doesn't want any protected status to continue for Salvadorans and others.
Right.
So that's the question, is this going to blow up compromise totally?
Right. So if we talk about temporary protected status, that was also, as we said, in the news this week, and the issue of Salvadorans and not having their temporary protected status extended. So that will end in 2019. And there are some who say that this is going to have a significant impact on Massachusetts, some 6,000 Salvadorans employed here, and a significant economic impact. Could that be any kind of a bargaining tool here on the part of people who want this, or do you think that wouldn't affect this White House? Michael Kern.
Yeah, I think, ultimately, you're stacking up populations of people who are disturbed by this administration's immigration policies. And now it's Salvadorans, right? It was Haitians, Salvadorans. The list has grown. It was his ban on certain countries. So I think this latest one, just as a reminder that people come here, whether there's a war in their country or they come here because there's a natural disaster, and they come here and they create families and they contribute to our economies and they make a difference and they're contributing. Most of them come here and do great things. If it's just raising a family, and we're in a place now where this administration's rhetoric characterizes them in a way that we need them out. It's deeply disturbing. It's very un-American. And we have to be vocal. Every listener who's a listener of this show, every advocate, every person who cares about this stuff has to speak out.
Hmm. I want to talk about the wall, because this is a big part of this, right? And it was a big part, apparently, of this reported bipartisan deal on immigration, right, Joe?
So we
were told that part of the deal to reform also would have asked for concessions or some money for some kind of border protection. Congressman Kennedy says if there was a deal to protect DACA, that he might support some funding for quote-unquote border protection, whatever that means. And we spoke on the show with Senator Ed Markey earlier this week after the first immigration meeting with President Trump. I know that seems like it was about a year ago, but it was really just, earlier this week.
2 days ago.
It was before the remark controversy. But Senator Markey told us this week that there is no way that Democrats will support the president's border wall. Let's listen.
I think the Democrats are open to new technologies being used along the border. The president's already retreating from having a wall across the totality of the southern border, saying that technologies could be used. But under no circumstances are the Democrats going to vote for the $18 billion for a wall.
So Joe Battenfeld, what do you think of Senator Markey's comments there? Do they suggest there might be a little bit of room?
I think there is some room for compromise there. And I think that Trump, could come out of this looking like a win. If he doesn't have funding for an actual wall, that looks like that. There's no way that compromise is going to happen where a wall gets built. But if he can point to anything saying we got increased security, billions more in increased security, maybe using drones, maybe using fences instead of walls or more just beefed up security, he could argue that he got a win out of it. And the Democrats could say they held firm, too, and got DACA done. So I do think that is possible, that they could reach a compromise there.
Now, this compromise is included, or this alleged compromise was included in a spending bill, which has to be approved by a week from today, so to avoid a government shutdown. Right. So that was just to further complicate all of this. And some immigration advocates say that if this spending plan does not include some sort of DACA reform, then what lawmakers are doing is essentially deporting young immigrants. So are Democrats in a difficult place here? Will they, you know, essentially have to say no compromise until we have DACA reform, and otherwise we'll force the government shutdown? Really, what might happen
here? Yeah, I think, you know, it's a very tough position for the minority party to be in, is that you know that there's some critical issues that have come up. The tax reform was one. You have the reauthorization of CHIP and community health centers and the health extender programs. There's a long list of unfinished business in Congress right now, and they're in a position. I've talked to Kennedy staff and Warren staff and others, and they're stressed about this because they don't want to necessarily accept the poison pills that sometimes comes with these bills. The wall to them is one that many of them don't want to compromise on, and there are others. So the repeal of the ACA, the undermining of the ACA. They're going to have to compromise in some way, and I'm hoping that they stick to their principles and can fix DACA and some of these other outstanding items before the 19th or on the 19th, because if we kick the can down the road, there's no certainty that we'll address. And this is about children. This is about families that will not have access to coverage or will be deported. Shame on us if we can't find a way to get there.
Tell your thoughts.
Yeah, and Trump could actually not just blame Democrats for not getting a spending bill done and shutting down the government. He could blame them for not getting an agreement on DACA, because it was his challenge months ago where he said, you legislators have to come up with a DACA plan.
And if it expires on March 6th, right?
Exactly. Yeah. If they don't get it done, Democrats could get blamed for that as well by Trump.
Okay, well, maybe we'll move on to another set of controversial comments.
There's no shortage, right?
These ones were local, and they're about marijuana and the implications of the Justice Department saying that federal prosecutors should aggressively enforce laws against pot. This, of course, after voters in Massachusetts approved the legalization of recreational marijuana. So we finally got some comments from Massachusetts U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling this week, and he said his office, quote, cannot provide assurances that certain categories of participants in the state-level marijuana trade will be immune from federal prosecution. And, of course, that set off a storm here and a lot of questions about what's going on. But then we had Public Safety Secretary Dan Bennett say the state has no intention of raiding a pot shop. Boston police say they're not going to actively enforce federal marijuana laws at the local level. And on Tuesday, this is what Governor Baker said.
The big message to the U.S. Attorney's Office should be, if you have limited resources, let's focus on the thing that's killing people here every day in the Commonwealth, which is street drugs and fentanyl.
So the governor essentially saying, why don't you pay attention to the opioid epidemic and not worry about marijuana, U.S. Attorney Lelling. What's your take on this, Michael Curry?
Yeah, it's all pomp and circumstance to some degree to me. I think as we see play out in politics is when you track this stuff is, you know, the U.S. attorney winning some cool points, some political cool points with the U.S. The attorney general. And the reality is that we have, as many states have, marijuana laws now on the books. And it creates this conflict between state and federal law that no one really wants to deal with.
Right.
And the reality is you don't want to, as many Republicans will argue for states' rights and state sovereignty and the rest, you don't want to get into a situation where you're now battling states over their right to choose laws that their voters have called for.
Mm-hmm. Yet, I mean, those were fairly stark comments from Massachusetts U.S. attorney, especially compared with other U.S. attorneys in other states. They weren't making as decisive a comment as that regarding potential prosecution.
And I think some of that is, and if I remember correctly, his position is a lot more firm than many of the other attorney generals, U.S. attorneys across the country haven't been confirmed. So, I mean, again, it's an opportunity for him to position himself with Jeff Sessions, and it's a position that he can take that'll get him some recognition nationally and get him some recognition with this administration. I think, you know, it's a good political move, but I don't think there's much there.
Okay, so you don't think he's really going to do much of anything?
I don't believe so. Mm.
But some of the state's medical marijuana dispensaries this week notified their customers that they will no longer accept credit card payments. And they said it was because of these comments from U.S. Attorney Lelling. Joe, what do you think? I mean, yeah. Do these comments, maybe there won't be a real prosecution. Maybe it's just a little saber rattling and a political move, but does it affect the industry?
That's the question, really. I agree that there probably won't be a crackdown, especially on, we're talking about two different things, medical marijuana and recreational sales of marijuana, which are now legal in Massachusetts, or which will be legal in a couple months. You know, if the U.S. attorney should actually go after a crackdown on medical marijuana, that would be outrageous, considering the fact that we have this fentanyl problem. I agree with Governor Baker. Go after fentanyl. Fentanyl is what's killing people. Like 80% of the opioid overdoses are because of illicit fentanyl. And if you go after pot, like medical marijuana, that is outrageous. So I don't think he's going to do that. But I do think there is a question of what impact it will have on the industry. Will it discourage investors? Will it hurt financial backing for some of these pot businesses that are just getting started? You know, because it's a very, very lucrative business, billions of dollars, lucrative business. So it's very important that people have the security that, hey, if I invest in something, it's, you know, they're not going to shut it down.
Right.
So that's the real question. But I don't think there's going to be a crackdown. I certainly hope there's not a crackdown on medical marijuana.
Some are suggesting that this could result in Congress taking action. When Congress, you know, lifting the ban on marijuana, so then there's no arguments, no more. It's no longer illegal under federal law.
There's already a bill that's been filed by a Republican just a few days ago to make medical marijuana, to make marijuana in states that have it legal, kept legal from the federal government. So that's the kind of thing that they need in order to be really secure. But it could happen.
Yeah, I think the divide is still there. I think even if you watch what happened here in Massachusetts with many of the people who are now opposing the U.S. attorney's comments, they were once opponents of the passage of recreational marijuana.
Right.
And these are
Governor
some Democrats.
Baker, Maura Healey, and you know, all of these folks were opponents.
So when it gets down to D.C., you'll have the same thing play out. It's bipartisan in the fact that many people have not adjusted to the decriminalization of marijuana, and they would likely have a challenge getting it passed.
Okay, let's last topic here. What I'd like to talk about is the WBUR poll that came out this week. 500 likely Massachusetts voters, about three quarters of them said that they approve of the job that Charlie Baker is doing as governor. Our pollsters say Baker has so-called honeymoon numbers right now, right? 3 years into his term, which is highly unusual for a governor. They say Baker has appeal across party line. So we spoke with some of the folks who responded to the poll. Among them was Eleanor Jones from Groton, a Democrat, explaining why she voted for Republican Governor Charlie Baker. Let's listen.
He's there for everybody, you know, and he's trying to get, you know, with the opioid problem and everything. He's trying his best. I think he's a good guy. I think he's going to be around for quite some time.
So I'm wondering, Joe Battenfeld, why do you think that Charlie Baker continues to have mass appeal in a Democratic state?
Well, because he has been a very moderate governor. He's tried very hard not to align himself with Donald Trump, to keep as far distance as he possibly can from Donald Trump. And he comes across as a moderate guy who's concerned about the budget, concerned about fiscal issues, and a very, just sort of, compared to Trump especially, a very agreeable sort of guy, a very rational guy, and that he doesn't, he's not overly partisan either.
Right.
And that's,
oh my gosh,
point.
A rational Republican.
Yeah, that being said, I don't think he's a shoo-in for re-election.
Huh.
I think the numbers are so strong here that there's so few Republicans in the state. We know Republicans are going to vote, most Republicans will vote for Baker, although there is a lot of dissatisfaction among some Republicans with Baker. But he'll probably have that locked up, most of that locked up. The question is Democrats and that person that you interviewed, if there are a lot of people like that, then Baker will win. But if a Democrat, nobody knows the Democrats yet. That's what the poll indicated.
Right.
But that it's still a long ways away.
Right. So,
and whoever's a nominee could catch fire. Suddy Warren, you never know, could catch fire. Then all of a sudden the poll looks close. Elizabeth Warren's race is also this year. If she generates a huge turnout of Democrats, that could also hurt Governor Baker. So I don't think it's over.
Mm-hmm. But we should say Seti Warren and Jay Gonzalez, Bob Massey. Those are the three Democratic potential opponents of the governor. And our poll did show about two-thirds of voters have no idea.
Right.
Who they are. And when Senator Markey, when we spoke with him earlier this week, he said Democrats overall definitely have work to do, but they shouldn't be worried yet. Let's listen to what he said.
The Democratic Party has yet to select a candidate, and so we have three good candidates who are out there and whose name recognition is going to rise as each week and month goes by, and they will become very well known before we hit election day.
That's Senator Markey talking about the gubernatorial race here in Massachusetts and the Democratic candidates who appear to be unknown at this point, at least according to the latest WBUR poll. Michael Curry, do you agree? Do you think it's still a little early and we can't say yet?
It's early, but it's concerning if you're a Democrat because these are high numbers for the governor and that there's a delta there and there's a need for the Democrats to kick in a gear, select a candidate and move forward. One of the challenges I mentioned even on this show previous was in the city of Boston election that when Tito ran against Mayor Walsh is that you're coming in with less money. You have a challenge to basically raise the issues where in that case the mayor hadn't done enough. And in this case, the other candidates will need to raise the issues. Okay, you like him. He's the opioid governor. He's done some great things. But here's what we could have done under a different governor if I were governor. Mm-hmm. And that challenge, you don't have a lot of runway to do that work. That's a lot of mailings. That's a lot of robocalls. That's a lot of speaking engagements. And if the voters do not know who they are, it is not bode well for the Democratic Party to take back the governor's office.
The T is a big issue. Always has been ever since Charlie Baker took office. And this poll had some good news about the T. 45% of those polled approve of how Governor Baker has handled the MBTA, and fewer than 20% said they disapproved. And I will say Boston Globe columnist Joan Vanocki said she was surprised by these numbers in her column this week. And she said, really? Really? Folks, and she's urging riders to want more from their public transit. She's suggesting that perhaps folks have just given up and been beaten down by the status of the T. But, Joe, I'm wondering, does Governor Baker deserve some credit here for the MBTA's performance?
I think he deserves credit for making it an important issue and for making it a priority. But he doesn't deserve credit for turning around. Certainly, the T still has enormous problems. Anybody who rides it can tell you that they're delayed. If you have to go to a meeting and you're relying on the T to get there in time, forget it. So I think this is a potential vulnerability for Baker. I think the fact that 45% say, approve of his performance is probably more of a spillover of his popularity than anything, and not necessarily a specific endorsement of his handling of the MBTA. But, we're not through the winter yet. If there are no more big storms, if the T has even bigger problems this time around, definitely Governor Baker should be held accountable.
And I have to mention her name because I try to whenever we have this conversation, is Beverly Scott,
yep.
Who foreshadowed all of these problems, that it needed investment and there were long-term systemic issues with our transportation system. And they sort of hung all of this on her neck. And
the T general manager.
T general manager. So
right.
I think as we're seeing play out that these issues are longstanding and they require serious focus because, quite frankly, people are frustrated that they can't get to where they need to get to in Massachusetts.
Okay. Well, let's try to end on a light note here with our hubbubs. And those are sort of the brief stories that maybe caught our attention this week that are a little bit lighter. Joe, you have a hubbub this week?
Yes. Animal attacks.
Oh.
Not so much the light, but it's kind of funny. There are sea lions in San Francisco that are trying to take a bite out of swimmers. That's become dangerous. Oh. Not only that, but there is a killer owl on the loose in Maine. Not really a killer owl, I'm just kidding about that, but it's a very aggressive dive bombing owl that's terrorizing cross-country skiers along a popular trail. But it turns out the owl is probably a great horned owl. It's not angry, it's just breeding. It's breeding season for owls right now, and they're just trying to protect their nest. So don't be worried, people. You could go out and enjoy the outdoors. I think it'll be fine.
All right. That sounds good. I'd rather be swimming than cross-country skiing right about now. How about you, Michael?
Well, like many of us in the last 2 weeks, I spent time figuring out how I was going to spend $500+ million in the Powerball or $400+ million in Mega Millions, and I literally was depressed when I found I didn't win either. But looking at the
maybe a relative, right? No one's come forward in
funny.
New Hampshire. Right?
I hope it's a relative. but the article on the richest people in Massachusetts intrigued me. $118 billion among that group. And of course, among them is the casino mogul Dorchester native for the Dot folks, Dorchester. Sheldon Adelson at $26.4 billion. It's Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. I think of the hip-hop songs, Cash Rules Everything Around Me, Dollar Dollar Bill, y'all. So I thought that was interesting.
All right. Well, I think I'll have to save mine for next time. Michael Curry, former president of the Boston branch of the NAACP and a member of the National NAACP Board of Directors, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Also, Joe Battenfeld, Boston Herald political reporter and columnist and host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Joe, thank you.
Thank you, Deb.
Stay with us. Coming up, we speak with Congressman Joe Kennedy. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.